This is Mark Sobel, U.S. Chair of OMFIF. Today, I have the great pleasure of hosting Brent McIntosh, Undersecretary for International Affairs at the U.S. Treasury. Earlier in the administration, Brent was the General Counsel at the Treasury, and before that, he was a partner at Sullivan & Cromwell and served in prestigious posts in the White House and Department of Justice during the Bush administration. I spent my career working for Undersecretaries for International Affairs. His predecessors represent a long line of distinguished Americans. The undersecretary usually isn't a household name, but make no mistake, every central bank governor and every finance minister in the world knows that Brent, backed by the talented Treasury International Civil Service team, is the day-to-day go-to person on almost every key aspect of U.S. international economic and financial relations, whether it's the G7, the G20, the IMF, the World Bank, the approach to the Financial Stability Board, and a range of bilateral relations. Welcome, Brent. We're delighted you took time to speak with us today.
Delighted to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me, and thanks to OMFIF for doing this event.
Thank you. So let's get into it. The pandemic has heavily disrupted our economies. There have been many G7, G20, IMF, FSB discussions. Some say the G20 has been missing in action. Since you're in the middle of all these discussions, maybe you could start off by discussing your pandemic international engagement. What do you see as the key accomplishments and misses? And let's be frank, many perceive the Trump administration as not being a fan of multilateralism or international engagement. How has that impacted your efforts to address the pandemic on the economic and financial fronts?
Well, I'd say that the interesting thing about international engagement in the course of the pandemic is that although the in-person contacts have gone to near zero from relatively frequent international travel, nonetheless, the pace and intensity of the international engagement we've had, both bilaterally and multilaterally, have gone up dramatically. We, like so many others, have become proficient with Zoom and WebEx and all the other platforms and are using them extensively for purposes of international engagement. That's not a perfect substitute for in-person meetings because you do lose out on the casual hallway conversations in which a huge amount of work gets done. Nonetheless, it has been salutary to watch the way the international community is, and in particular both the finance ministries and central bank governors have managed to smoothly transition to a virtual engagement and be productive. Just to give you a sense of how this all went, in late February, when the G20 finance ministers and central bank governors met in Riyadh, the only country that was not able to send an in-person delegation from their capital was China. A week later, I hosted the finance ministers and central bank governors' deputies in Baltimore, as were the G7 presidency. And for that, the Italians were unable to come in person. And by a week later, basically all international travel of that nature had shut down, come to a screaming halt. But the interactions we've had, whether it's the G7 or the G20, the Financial Stability Board, our work with the World Bank and the IMF, other multilateral development banks, these have all ramped up in intensity. Bilateral engagements have continued apace. I think that I was counting the other day, and I think I've had bilateral engagements with more than 50 different countries since the advent of the pandemic. There are new mechanisms in place for interaction. So, for example, during the pandemic, we've started a discussion among the Five Eyes finance ministers, which is to say the U.S., Canada, U.K., Australia, New Zealand, which has traditionally been had a security alliance and intelligence sharing alliance, but had not been the subject of finance ministers cooperation. And we've been doing that to great effect. And, you know, we have in the United States, we've leveraged our G7 presidency as well as our shareholding in the international financial institutions and the authorities received in the CARES Act to work intensely on the global economic and financial response. So if you look, for example, at the FSB led ably by Randy Quarles from the Fed, the FSB has taken intense measures on coordinating COVID responses and sharing best practices, looking at the effects of the pandemic on potential effects on financial stability, working on digital payments, which have become all the more important in the context of the pandemic, and then looking at non-bank financial intermediation and how it has been affected during the pandemic. And then similarly, if you look at us at Treasury, we've managed to intensify our international engagements on investment screening. So our CFIUS process has spent a good deal of the pandemic talking to foreign counterparts about their practices. So in a variety of different ways, the speed and scale of the crisis has been met by the speed and scale of the response. We have continued to be fully engaged internationally despite the inability to really travel much.
Well, thank you for that. And we'll drill down on some of the subjects you mentioned there. So the IMF World Bank annual meetings are coming up next week. You're going to have G7, G20, IMFC development committee meetings. You'll discuss the global economic outlook, international financial institutions, and debt. We can come back to the DSSI later, but some of the latest forecasts show a less steep global recession this year. But there will be a lot of scarring from the crisis. I think we're only at the end of the beginning. Japan and Europe have long been in the doldrums. The U.S. is seeing declining potential growth over time. China needs to move to a more sustainable growth model. And all of this is happening while the crisis unfolds. So, you know, what are the key issues and your objectives for the meetings?
This will be the second time the meetings have been held virtually. The spring meetings were also held virtually. And when you look at where we are this time around versus where we were in the spring meetings, at that time there was very substantial uncertainty and market turmoil. Now, if you look at, as you referenced, Mark, a lot of the data are trending in a positive way. And that's, I think, a response that's in consequence of a lot of the actions taken by a variety of different countries, including very prominently the actions taken here. But there's still a lot to do, a massive amount to do, as you referenced the Churchill line, the end of the beginning. And it's very true that we cannot declare victory at this point. We need to continue pushing for responsive measures. So I think our first message in the meetings is going to be that countries need to be not withdrawing support prematurely and instead calibrating further support to the needs and situations of their countries based on health metrics as well as economic metrics. That's a lesson both for us and for foreign countries, and that's why we continue to negotiate a further stimulus package. The Secretary has been negotiating with Speaker Pelosi on that, and we're hopeful that we'll come to an agreement on that. Second, there has been a rapid expansion of financing to the hardest hit countries. And so you're working with those countries to ensure that they have policies in place for long-term growth, that they have strong debt management practices, and emphasizing the need for strong debt management practices and debt transparency and sustainability. That's always been a priority of Treasuries, of international affairs of Treasury, and that will be, it's all the more important now. In the World Bank, that's going to be talking about the need to target aid to the neediest countries and focus that aid on development. In the IMF, it's going to be returning to bilateral surveillance and making sure that we're focused on lending that will create better policies. I think we can get back to a more normal IMF policies there. We will continue to push, as I said, on debt transparency, sustainability, and also to address where there is unsustainable debt in various countries. I think we're moving from a period when we were looking primarily at providing liquidity to determining where there are unsustainable debt cases. And that we'll also obviously be discussing extending the debt service suspension initiative, which we can, I'm sure, discuss later. And then I mentioned earlier digital payments. We're going to continue to discuss those because the digital payment space has been evolving rapidly even during the pandemic. And so you look at topics like, for example, the evolution in the stablecoin space and other crypto assets. We're delivering a report to the G20 next week on regulatory issues around stablecoins. There's also a lot of work being done around cross-border payments. And then the G7 has been working to coordinate its own position on digital payments and digital assets because I think it behooves the major economies to get together and have a standardized position on that.
So U.S.-China relations have been at the forefront of the Treasury's international engagement for the last two decades. I worked for Secretary Snow, Paulson, Geithner, and Liu, and we spent enormous time engaging China across a broad front of economic and financial issues, especially the RMB. The Obama administration's view of China darkened considerably, I think, in the second term with the ascent of Xi Jinping. There were concerns that this administration strongly and rightly shares about industrial policy, forced technology transfers, state subsidization, etc. But the hallmark of, I would say, Bush and Obama periods was engagement through strategic dialogues. This administration started with a comprehensive economic dialogue, but called it off. Relations have been tense across a broad front, understandable in many cases. It seems to me that China and the U.S. need to find areas where they can engage. Both have a common interest in a healthy and growing global economy. I've seen recently J.P. Morgan, Citi, and BlackRock have been stepping up their engagement in China. And yet Chinese investment in the U.S. is drying up, and you play a prominent role on CFIUS. In my time, there were huge discussions behind the scenes between the Chinese and the U.S., and they were very frank and professional. The Chinese are well-educated interlocutors that we have, often trained in the U.S. Could you tell us a bit about the substance and the amount of your engagement with the Chinese, often behind the scenes, I would guess, and how has the broader U.S.-China climate impacted that engagement and the investment climate, and is decoupling possible?
You're right that the strategic and economic dialogue has transformed in this administration into a more targeted approach to engagement with China, focused on a variety of issues that have real importance, I think, for the economic connections between the two countries, and in particular various Chinese practices that do not meet our vision of market-based practices. So, for example, market access barriers, IP theft, forced technology transfers, and then also we referenced earlier debt transparency and sustainability in low-income countries. And so we do, in addition to the phase one trade deal that was struck with China and the agreements there, we do discuss a number of those topics with the Chinese. I would say that there continues to be engagement. We at Treasury continue to be engaged with our Chinese counterparts. I would characterize those discussions as frank and professional. I agree with your characterization of them as well-informed and thoughtful and intellectually capable interlocutors. I do have, and I know the Secretary does have, regular bilateral engagements with the Chinese. His are obviously publicized, but we also have some staff-level contact, working groups and otherwise, as well as regular, consistent multilateral engagement with the Chinese. We see them in a variety of places, whether it's the G20 or otherwise. And Treasury, as well, is actively involved in the discussions with the Chinese about compliance with the phase one trade deal commitments, including in particular, we're focused on the market opening measures for financial services. So there continues to be a good deal of bilateral and multilateral engagement with the Chinese. I think there's no question that there have been challenges in that relationship during this administration, and we continue to want the Chinese to come to international best practices there. I would just take a moment and discuss CFIUS. You referenced it, and it's obviously been a very important part of the work of this administration vis-a-vis capital flows. Foreign direct investment and free capital flows are obviously an engine of growth all over the world, including in the United States. And we continue to believe that the United States is the best place in the world to invest. To protect that investment environment, we're very focused on the idea that it is vigilant, rigorous scrutiny of inbound foreign investment that allows us to protect national security while nonetheless remaining a place that is free for foreign direct investment in the United States. And so even before the pandemic, there was the most thoroughgoing reform of the CFIUS process, our Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States process, that has been undertaken in the past four decades. And so we were working very much on working through the different reforms there, including an expansion of CFIUS's jurisdiction to certain transactions that previously would not have been captured. But with the pandemic, we've needed to step up our game very substantially. the situation now from an investment standpoint is, if you were an investor with malign intentions for your investment into the United States, you might see, at least early in the pandemic, you might have seen lowered valuations, which made for targets of opportunity, as well as thinking that there was going to be distraction by national authorities. So rather than be distracted, we have really stepped up our scrutiny of investment in the United States to ensure we're not being disadvantaged by the pandemic in that space. And we've also, as I mentioned earlier, really engaged intensely with foreign counterparts to ensure that they are getting the benefit of our lessons learned over the past four decades. So the CFIUS process has, if anything, ramped up during the pandemic.
And I know Heath Tarbert, before he left, worked heavily on Firma, and I think your administration has received good marks for that endeavor. So I mentioned the debt service suspension initiative for low-income countries. I think it's a good idea in principle. The private sector doesn't appear to be participating. So that would mean that when multilateral finance is extended to LICs, it allows private sector exposure to roll off. In the 90s and 2000s, the G7 and others eliminated their debts to low-income countries through HIPC and MIDRI. I spent a long time working on that. Now China's a dominant creditor, as you've suggested, but China isn't a member of the Paris Club. It doesn't follow Paris Club principles. It's unclear if some of the Chinese actors, China Development Bank or China Exim, are participating in the DSSI or what China considers private and official. And then the DSSI is only about providing debt relief on debt service. But many low-income countries, I think, are going to suffer extensively due to the crisis and will need debt reduction. So in my view, the DSSI has been a bit of a disappointment. Is it a disappointment? What needs to be done? And any thoughts on emerging markets who may be suffering the same fate?
When we look at the DSSI, we need to think about what its fundamental goal, which was to support the poorest and most vulnerable countries and to take funds that they would have used for debt service and allow them to devote those to pandemic relief. And so I think in achieving that goal, the DSSI has been an important first step in aiding the poorest and most vulnerable countries. I will say the adoption of the DSSI in terms of its speed and scale was really rapid. Kristalina Georgieva at the IMF and David Malpass at the World Bank suggested this idea, and the G7, through our G7 presidency, sat down and said, we would be willing to do this as long as there was a G20 consensus on doing it. And then the G20 agreed to it in April. That was a very rapid adoption. From my perspective, you have 43 countries participating, freed up $5 billion worth of fiscal space. So it's been a success so far. There is a question of the extension of the DSSI, which we will face next week. In evaluating that extension, we do need to take account of the fact that there have been challenges in implementation, as you reference, and work through how to address those challenges. You referenced the private sector participation. I think there are also concerns among many countries about China's full and faithful participation. The G7 finance ministers and central bank governors did put out a statement showing good consensus on the way forward here. I will say that we would like more private sector participation. I know that countries have concerns about downgrades and continuing market access that have led them at times not to ask for private sector participation. But we're engaged in a continued push on that, which will also be very important when we get to the debt relief issues, which we can talk about in a moment. Also, with regard to China, we need, and all official bilateral creditors, we do need to see full, faithful, transparent compliance. China is the largest bilateral lender here. And so what we need to see from official bilateral lenders is transparency, not imposing non-disclosure agreements, not using collateralized financing. We need them to adhere to commonly agreed definitions of what is an official bilateral creditor. So that should be including government ministries, DFIs, development finance institutions, policy banks, export credit agencies and other instruments that are working at the behest of governments. And then we really need to also be raising credit reporting standards. And I will say the World Bank and the IMF have been doing a nice job in terms of reporting credit data, but we need to raise our game on credit reporting standards, not just as a matter of one-off DSSI, but it needs to be an institutionalized aspect of the reform of sovereign lending. And, you know, that a high degree of transparency with regard to credit will lead to better policy outcomes as people, as countries know what their situation is and as multilaterals know what their situation is. You do reference the fact that there's going to be a need for debt relief. At this point, we've been working on liquidity support, but some countries are definitely going to need debt relief because of unsustainable situations. And I think the Chinese will be key there as well. And so we're working with like-minded countries on a plan for how to address that. We've been discussing it in the G7. You know, we'll need to have agreements on, for example, the scope of creditor participation, fair burden sharing, comparability of treatment, as you referenced, and transparency going forward. So there's a lot of work to be done here, but I don't think we should minimize the importance of the DSSI over as a step in that, in moving forward to help the poorest and most vulnerable countries.
Great. Thank you. That's a tall agenda you have going forward, especially when debt restructuring will be needed. The fund has adequate resources for its lending to emerging markets, but sticking to the poorest countries, the IMF is trying to mobilize more financing for its lending to these countries and for debt relief to them. Might the U.S. contribute to this fundraising effort?
Thanks, Mark. I don't want to get ahead of my friends at the Office of Management and Budget, but what I will say is we have been working with OMB to figure out what's possible for the United States. We recognize that most of the measures we would take would require legislation. And so we obviously need OMB's blessing on that. We know that many members of Congress are also focused on this issue. We have encouraged other countries to lend their existing SDRs to help out in this situation. And so obviously the case that the administration has not supported a new SDR allocation here because we don't think it's either targeted to where it needs to be targeted or temporary. But there are clearly things that the international community can do to assist the IMF, and we're working with OMB to determine what the U.S. contribution to that will be.
Well, working with OMB was always a challenge in my career, so my sympathies. So let's turn to currency diplomacy. The administration has sought to bring currency issues directly into trade deals, whereas before with TPP, for example, we would have handled them separately. Because we were concerned that current account positions and exchange rates reflect macro forces, which were not topics that could be part of trade discussions and negotiations. On the FX report, you've changed some of the thresholds, it seems, to pick up more countries. China was designated for manipulation despite a small current account surplus and little intervention. Currency undervaluation now can be seen as a countervailable subsidy, which is something that I remember Hank Paulson fought against vigorously and saw as WTO inconsistent. There were reports a week ago about currency 301 cases. And plus, many say the administration has resorted more to unilateral financial sanctions, which may over time erode the dollar's reserve status. So how would you characterize the Trump administration's approach to currency issues and the dollar's reserve role?
What I would say is that we have been working assertively and proactively in this administration to combat unfair barriers to trade, and as well as unfair currency practices, and those sometimes go hand in hand. So if you look at both the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement and the Phase 1 China agreement, they incorporate commitments to avoid unfair currency practices as well as to publish relevant information. If you look at the effects, the dynamic effects of pushing on unfair currency practices, we have Korea has begun disclosing, reporting data in March of last year. Other countries have increasingly been improving their reporting of intervention. Transparency of reserves and intervention has clearly improved over time. But there's a lot more we can do. We do appreciate that the IMF is putting its support behind publication of intervention. With regard to the measures you referenced, we have been working with other agencies to address unfair trade practices, including where those are potentially based on unfair currency practices. So working with, as you referenced, Commerce on possible situations where government action on the exchange rate is intended to create underlying subsidy for trade. We at Treasury here in International Affairs have put together a state-of-the-art model to model currency valuation. We're very proud of it. We published the methodology on our website. You know, I think that the point to be made here is that other agencies have authorities and tools that they can use to push on unfair trade practices, even those potentially related to currency. The administration has been assertively trying to address those unfair trade practices. But on questions of currency valuation and foreign exchange practices, where the administration still looks to Treasury's expertise and experience for evaluation of those matters. So in both the countervailing duties context as well as other contexts with the U.S. trade rep, such as the recent announcement of a 301 investigation, there's very clearly an intention to come to Treasury for its views on the valuation of the currencies in question and the exchange rate practices. With regard to the dollar, what I'll say is that at this point, the dollar continues to be firmly entrenched as the reserve currency of the world, and that is consistent with sound economic policies. So on that, I don't think there's a lot more to say. We do try to be judicious in our use of sanctions, and that is consistent with the continued status of the dollar as a reserve currency.
Apart from China, many Asian countries run significant current account surpluses and have large and often rising reserves. Switzerland also falls into this category. Germany doesn't have its own currency, but does run a massive current account surplus. We've been dealing with these issues a long time at Treasury, but do you have worries about these large trade surpluses, and how are you dealing with them?
As you certainly recall from your decades here, Treasury has always pushed for stronger and more balanced growth, and we see those two things as linked. Balanced growth does tend to be stronger, so countries with large and persistent trade surpluses, we urge them to pursue reforms that will allow them to have domestically driven growth. Different countries, obviously, there are different policy prescriptions. Some countries, the basis of their trade surplus is unfair currency practices, undervaluation, one-sided interventions. On the other hand, and for those, I would say we push for high standards, as we were just discussing, and for transparency. On the other hand, many countries, including some that you referenced, the issue is not currency intervention, FX intervention, but macroeconomic and structural policies that favor export-oriented growth. So things like suppressing wage growth, inhibiting consumption, policies that prevent or discourage private sector investment. And for those, we consistently urge both bilaterally and multilaterally that they reform, that they remove those restrictions, and that they move toward boosting domestically oriented growth, domestically driven growth. We think on both the currency-related policies and the macroeconomic and structural policies that removing those distortions will be a win-win, because countries will find, the households in those countries will find that they have increasing wages and consumption, and the United States will be competing on a fair playing field. So both in bilateral discussions with them and at places like the G20, we do urge that they move in the direction of domestically driven growth.
So one of the most critical groups I worked on in the Treasury period was the Financial Stability Board, which really doesn't get the attention I think it deserves. And I'd also like to praise Randy Quarles, who used to be one of my bosses at Treasury as well. So I spent a lot of time working on FSB issues and working to improve financial cooperation also with the European Union. I started the US-EU Financial Dialogue, which I heard you last chaired. It's called a forum now. I think that we did a good job after the crisis in strengthening bank capitalization, liquidity, and leverage, but risks have gravitated towards non-bank financial intermediation, as you mentioned at the outset. So what are your priorities in the FSB and the US-EU dialogue, and particularly with Brexit looming? And I also thought that the March turmoil in the repo and the treasury markets highlighted excessive interconnectedness, leverage, and liquidity transformation among the key non-bank financial intermediaries. And I would like to know if you see this as a problem that needs to be tackled in the United States and the FSB.
Let me start with the US-EU forum and talk a bit about that before turning to the FSB. The forum has really been a great mechanism to foster regulatory and supervisory cooperation, which I think has the potential to enhance growth on both sides of the Atlantic and to reduce frictions. So we focus there recently on a number of areas where we have similar objectives. So for example, most recently, we discussed the financial stability challenges arising out of the pandemic. We've also been discussing the effect of LIBOR transition. But we also take on a number of tough issues where we may not have agreements. So, for example, one of the things we discuss is the effects on institutions of the EU's data policies that can and sometimes hinder data flows that are, from our perspective, beneficial for purposes of risk management, cybersecurity, et cetera, et cetera. But there have been recent achievements to come out of that forum, including some agreements on the Volcker Rule, the U.S. not opting to directly supervise major U.S. CCPs, expansion of the trading venue exception exemption from certain CFTC registration requirements. So we continue to work with both the EU and the United Kingdom to ensure that the United Kingdom's withdrawal from the EU does not result in market fragmentation or results in the minimum amount of that and market dislocation that's possible. You know, we saw the EU's extension of CCP relief to the UK as a promising step. And we're working intensely as well with the Brits to ensure that we have smooth regulatory arrangements with the UK post-Brexit. Let me turn then to the FSB. The FSB, which really came into its full form after the global financial crisis, has been by any standard, a real success of the post-financial crisis reforms. It is a forum where the regulators and finance ministries can get together and have candid conversations about financial stability issues. And it's a group that knows each other and has trust each other and is capable of working together. And it leads to a coordination among financial authorities that has been, I think, central to the COVID response in many ways, albeit out of the public eye. The FSB has been continually collaborating since the advent of COVID to strengthen the response, to anticipate challenges, and to promote the recovery. You know, for example, one of the things that happened very early on that the FSB addressed was that it was clear that there was going to be a historic challenge to business continuity plans, that business continuity plans often depended upon workers in some other country being deemed essential. So that they could run whatever function it was for a global financial institution. And so the FSB and the United States as well pushed hard to ensure that those workers were deemed essential in whatever country they were working in so that we were not paralyzing global financial institutions merely because some function, whether it be back office or otherwise, suddenly stopped functioning because the workers couldn't get to work. And that was, I think, that was a successful effort. It took intense work over a period of weeks, but we got to a result there that I think was very good for the global financial system, but one that you don't really hear about. When things don't break, no one complains about them. And then, you know, the FSB also put in place a mechanism for sharing information about measures in response so that its members could collaborate and cooperate in real time on those responses. During the March market turmoil, the FSB was in regular communication because we saw that as an unparalleled disruption, not a sort of run-of-the-mill event in the markets, but something that was not could not really have been anticipated. And so to restore market functioning, both the actions that we took in the United States and the actions that were taken around the world, there was intense discussion about those and about how they were working. And, you know, banks and broker-dealers had entered the crisis in a historically strong position. And that prevented magnification of some of these risks, but the risks were very much there nonetheless. And so the FSB and the United States government as well had to spend a good deal of time addressing those risks and making sure that the financial industry continued to be a source of support for the real economy instead of turning to an impediment to the real economy. With regard to the points you mentioned about non-bank financial intermediation, there's a real ongoing effort both at the FSB and internal to the United States government to look at the interconnections between the non-bank financial sector, banks, corporates, and households, and explore how risks propagate through those interconnections, and as well as an ongoing effort to monitor the risks of solvency to non-financial corporates, particularly in the hardest hit sectors. So we, the FSB, standard-setting bodies, we're all looking at ways to enhance liquidity provision in times of stress, especially for non-banks. That's an effort that needs to be taken in a considered and thoughtful way, and I can tell you my friends in some of the regulatory agencies are spending an intense amount of time on this, and we are working alongside them as we do that. We're also looking at what happened with money market fund outflows from certain types of money market funds in terms of the structure and incentives and liquidity there. So there's a huge amount of work being done in light of the data. We recognize that with regard to the crisis, we are not out of the woods, but we nonetheless need to be looking even now at what happened in March and what the potential structural consequences of that are going forward.
Good. Well, I hope that's strongly carried forward. So time is short. So let me just ask you a final question. What keeps you up at night? What are the big risks out there that we haven't talked that you can envision? And what don't you do that you might want to do, but there's just not enough time in the day? I will say, in honor of you doing this interview with me today, go blue.
That's very kind of you. That actually it does keep me up at night, this worrying about whether Michigan can beat Ohio State for one. But in all seriousness, we've discussed a number of the things that do keep me up at night, including idea that countries may declare victory and prematurely withdraw support. That's not the time to do this. And when countries do that, it doesn't affect just their own country. It has knock-on effects elsewhere. It affects supply chains. It affects remittances. So there are all sorts of interconnections there. We need a robust, continued international and national response here. In terms of other things that I worry about, what I found interesting during this crisis is we articulated a set of priorities to work on for this year in international affairs here at Treasury before the pandemic really took hold early this year. And those items have only become more important and amplified in our focus. So those are things like working on debt transparency and sustainability. That felt like a topic where it was hard to get attention before the pandemic. There's no question people are paying attention to it now. Similarly, the role of China and a rising China in the global economy is a topic that was already on our priority list and has, for obvious reasons, become much more prominent in the global dialogue. And then things like, for example, digital payments, where the evolution of the space has continued despite the pandemic, and the importance of non-physical payments have become all the more prominent. And so we continue to work on that and ensuring that we have a robust discussion of the various public policy aspects around digital payments, and that we do move forward on speeding up and making more efficient and less costly the payment system. That has become all the more important during the pandemic as well. So the things that keep me up at night are still the same things. They just keep me up more.
Well, thank you for that. Tremendous thanks to you for joining us today. It was a review of a very rich agenda. I think it shows the breadth of the work international affairs at Treasury does, and we really only covered the tip of the iceberg. It's a very important job that you have, and honored that you could join us. And I hope that after today's interview, Brent McIntosh becomes a household name in America.